Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast. I'm Brian Curtis, along with Doug Krisner. Join us each day for the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. You can subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Earlier in the day, we heard from Fed Chair Jay Powell, and he was saying that the central bank needs to be patient as it awaits more evidence that high interest rates are doing a job on curbing inflation. At the same time, Mr. Powell seemed to double down on the need to keep those borrowing costs higher for longer.
I don't think that it's likely, based on the data that we have, that the next move that we make would be a rate hike. I think it's more likely that we'll be at a place where we hold the policy rate where it is.
Fed Chair Jay Powell speaking earlier today at an event in Amsterdam. He said that he expects inflation will move lower on a monthly basis. However, price figures in the first quarter have tempered that confidence just a bit. He spoke right after the PPI data that we had here in the U.S. for the month of April. It showed that inflation at the wholesale level rose last month more than forecast.
Let's get to Sean Darby, Managing Director at Mizuho Securities Asia, to talk a little bit more about the impact that report has and also how he sees markets moving over the short term. Sean, thank you very much for being with us here in our studios on a holiday, Buddha's birthday in Hong Kong, but nice to have you join us here. So when we look at that producer price data, of course, the headline data for month on month was kind of hot. But then you had these other mitigating factors. On balance, neutral in your view, or what?
Well, certainly the bond market took it reasonably well. Mm-hmm. So the curve actually dropped across all of the duration. I think one of the interesting aspects of the producer prices is actually corporates are retaining very, very strong pricing power. And that doesn't really mean that we're going to be seeing a recession that soon. Companies are not in a position at the moment to having to either protect margins particularly, or indeed feeling that they're going to have to lower prices to either clear inventory or garner demand. So all of this really, I think, sort of reinstates Fed chairperson's Powell view, which is that it's going to be higher for longer, and we're not going to be really seeing rate cuts potentially really until fourth quarter. And certainly the equity market isn't going to get any relief from a very big series of rate cuts, and perhaps until 2025.
You don't seem to be too surprised by that notion. Were you expecting the Fed to be on hold for the foreseeable future?
I really feel that at the moment, if you look at things like producer prices or credit spreads are very, very tight for where we are in the cycle. You have an inverted yield curve, credit spreads tight. They have not really presaged a recession at all over the last year. In fact, it's failed. I think the Fed recession model has been at 60% for nearly 12 months now. And the reason for that is that as people enter the workforce, they actually produce goods, their economic output picks up, and you get a sort of an enduring profit cycle as wages feed back into the economy. So ironically, at the moment, it's been more of a labor problem in this cycle than anything else. And certainly in that respect, you're not really going to see economic activity fade until sometime in 2025.
Yeah, and that seems to be most important because the earnings appear to be tied to economic growth and also the efficiency of companies and such. And as long as inflation doesn't get a lot worse, if it starts to go the other direction, then all bets are off, I suppose, because higher interest rates from the Fed would definitely get markets jangled. But if as long as we see growth, you sort of with the job growth, 175,000, that's not bad news is good news. That's like okay news is good news.
Yeah, I think the reality is that globally we've had an enormous period of immigration, and the OECD wrote about this in its outlook, I think, 2 weeks ago, that one of the important factors that's allowed the economic recovery to be extended was the fact that immigration has returned as being a big swing factor for labor markets in places like the US, UK, and Australia. And that has been perhaps the savior, actually, for these central banks, in a sense that they've not had to face recessionary problems. I think the other thing to remember is that the two cycles preceding, the cycle before the COVID was a deflationary one. COVID itself was a deflationary experience. But actually, all the cycles preceding those have actually been inflationary. And we're just sort of going back to learn what it looks like or how things are during a period where you are fighting inflation rather than fighting deflation. I think that's also been part of the problem for the bond market. Nobody really has had the experience, including myself as well.
Let's talk a little bit about geopolitics, because we have these new tariffs now on certain Chinese goods being implemented by the Biden administration. Not surprising that Beijing is going to blow back just a little bit and vow measures of its own. How do you kind of evaluate where we are right now in terms of U.S.-China tensions?
Well, I think the way to succinctly put it is things are not getting better and they're getting worse. And for me, I think we are still going to be in a cycle, even after the US elections, in which the whole trade sanctions and restrictions are going to be an ongoing theme, actually. So I think the way to put it is that we're going to have to live with further restrictions, further tariffs, and particularly at the high end, on the technology end, I don't see any glimmer of light in which the US is going to relax any of those exports or restrictions on semiconductors. So again, I think there's no sort of end game in this. This is going to be a theme that's going to continue for the next 3 to 4 years.
And U.S.-China rivalry on semiconductors brings Taiwan into the picture. Now, next week will be an important week. William Lai will be inaugurated as Taiwan president. He supports the status quo with China, Sean, but he calls himself a pragmatic worker for Taiwan independence. And the way that he gets at that is that Taiwan has de facto independence now, and so that's what the status quo means. But I'm curious whether or not you think we might see a Taiwan discount to be applied to the equity market there if he gets plucky.
I think the unusual thing at the moment is that, first of all, Taiwan and China's economies are inextricably linked. So if you look at the PMIs over a 3 or 4 year period, they generally sort of follow each other. There's a symbiotic relationship between the growth rates. The second thing is that in many respects, the economy now is in its own sort of inflationary boom, which is similar to what Japan is, where you have a very undervalued currency. You have a central bank that's pretty much quite far behind the curve and raising rates in contrast to everyone else. And thirdly, everywhere you look, whether it's from land prices or producer prices or CPI, core CPI, actually Taiwan's is actually inflating still. So in that respect, the political or geopolitics is actually being sort of surpassed by the fact that actually the economy is doing very well and on a very different path to what everyone else is experiencing globally. They've also got labor shortages and an extremely low unemployment rate. So I think in the sense geopolitics is actually being pushed to one side because the economy is actually doing pretty well in Taiwan.
But I'm curious about the outlook. If we can agree that there is just so much concentration of semiconductor semiconductor production vis-a-vis TSMC, and if countries like the U.S. are a little uneasy about the level of concentration and other chip makers seek to diversify away from Taiwan, including TSMC, which is actually helping to create facilities in the United States, might the economy go into a lower gear as the world becomes less dependent on chip manufacturing from TSMC, or is it simply too early to make that call?
No, that's a fair point. I think at the moment, as I said, you have this sort of inflationary bias which is working through the economy, mainly caused by a very cheap exchange rate. But your point is well taken. The irony is that the competitive part of Taiwan semiconductors is to some extent being hollowed out through this sort of onshoring in the developed world. And in that respect, you're not going to get the same level of output growth that you would have had in preceding cycles, you know, sometime in two or three years from now. So in that, you know, in fairness, that Taiwan is going to sort of see below trend growth from 2025, 26, purely because they don't have that same facilities in situ.
But you are sounding like a Taiwan bull, and you're also quite bulled up on the Hang Seng Tech Index. It is up 34% since February 1st. When is enough enough?
Well, I think the interesting thing about the Hang Seng Tech Index is that it's a pure look at everything that is more on the export side and nothing to do with real estate or finance. So it's a very clean way of getting to grips of how China's sort of other part of the economy is doing. And in fairness, the companies, I think we calculated 80% of them have got net cash on the balance sheet, free cash flow yields of on average 7%. It was a sort of outstanding bargain. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, I think there was a fair degree of catch-up for the HS Tech compared to all the other global indices in the past two quarters.
All right, Sean, thanks very much for joining us here on a holiday in our studios in Hong Kong. Sean Darby, Managing Director at Mizuho Securities.
Earlier today in the States, President Biden unveiled sweeping tariffs, an increase in tariffs on a range of Chinese imports. We're going to take a closer look now with our own John Liu, Bloomberg executive editor, joining us from our studios in Beijing. John, it's always a pleasure. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this really didn't go down too well in Beijing. Is that a fair statement?
I think that is a fair statement. This adds additional pressure on a relationship that is already very tense, that is already full of fractious disagreements. And so this is not making things any easier in any way.
John, is it also fair to say the flip side of it, that this may be a little bit more political on both sides than it is a real teeth in the action?
I think some of these tariffs were designed for maximum political advantage and maybe not so much for the impact on the economy. For example, there are not really many Chinese electric cars being exported to the United States from China, and so putting quadrupling the tariffs on those shipments is not going to have that big of an impact on bilateral trade. I think we saw something earlier when the Biden administration talked about putting additional tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum, which the U.S. buys very little of from China, and so a lot of this is more show than it is impact.
But I'm wondering if the subtext here is what we need to be talking about, which is the issue of overcapacity. I mean, that's been right out in the open from both sides, right? Not just from Treasury Secretary Yellen, but the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz as well.
That is a big issue, because the concern is that Chinese factories are making far more than can be consumed domestically. And so the obvious answer for China when it comes to what to do with all these goods being produced is to export them. And if cutting the prices, exporting those things at a cheaper price helps to move the product, and that is an obvious strategy, and that is something that would, of course, concern the Germans, the French, the Americans, lots of different markets around the world.
And of course, we started out with talking about China's response. We haven't seen it yet. It may amount to something quite material. It could be something directed at Tesla and companies like Apple. Have you been sort of looking at this, and what are we thinking?
So the Chinese have come out so far and said that they will take action to protect their rights. I think as they're trying to figure out what they should do next, they are going to have to balance a number of different factors. One, going after companies like Apple or Tesla, that's not going to be good for China's own economy because those companies are such large presences here, because they employ so many people. Discouraging foreign investment to China is not going to help Xi Jinping get the economy booming again. And so he's going to have to try and find some action that is both going to appease a domestic audience, which thinks that the government needs to stand up for China, but then also not shoot China in its own foot.
Don't we need to also take a look at proportionality? I mean, the leverage that we're talking about here from the U.S., that covers around $18 billion in goods for an $18 trillion economy. So this is literally a drop in the bucket.
Hmm. Well, I think the Chinese will take that into consideration. And I think there is a lot of mutual understanding that ahead of the this year's presidential election in the United States, that the rhetoric coming out of Washington is going to be more heated than normal. And I think also factoring into this is, of course, the other candidate in the race, former President Trump, and some of the more aggressive tariffs that he's talked about taking or putting into place if he were elected president. So there's a number of things in play here.
John, obviously trade is a big issue for China, but Taiwan is probably the biggest issue. And we have William Lai to be inaugurated next week as president. He supports the status quo, but he's always kind of leaned a little bit toward Taiwan independence. He calls himself a pragmatic worker for Taiwan independence. Should we be concerned that Taiwan, the economy, semiconductors, everything may get a little bit of a downgrade going forward as a result of that tricky relationship?
So I think Taiwan is definitely the most dangerous flashpoint in this relationship between the United States and China. Whether William Lai's ascendance to the presidential office will be the spark that sets off some sort of conflict, I think that looks relatively unlikely at the moment. We are expecting him to stick to the line from the previous administration of Taiwan. He has said that publicly. He plans to be a continuity president, if anything. I think the speech that he will be giving at his inauguration will be tuned to try and both show him and his party as defending Taiwan, but also not to cause any upsetness in Beijing or Washington.
John, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time to chat with us. Covered a lot of ground there with John Liu, Bloomberg Executive Editor in Beijing.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
We go to China next, and those big earnings reports that we had been waiting for. Tencent Holdings, on one hand, reported better than expected earnings, a 62% surge Okay, so that's the good news. On the other hand, Alibaba with a plunge in profit. We're talking about net income tumbling 86%. That's after an unexplained write-down for losses in Baba's publicly traded holdings. There was a little bit of commonality, though, among these two giants. Both Tencent and Alibaba reported better than expected revenue growth, although it was in the single digits. However, there was divergence when you look at the share prices. Here in New York, the ADRs and Tencent up about 4.7%, but the ADRs in Baba were down 6%. Brian?
Well, joining us now to discuss this is Vlad Savov, Bloomberg tech editor, who is looking very closely at the Tencent and Baba earnings and was on our blog, really getting to all the comments as they came, Vlad. Nice to have you with us in our studios. Let's start off with Alibaba first, because one of the things that we observed over the past many weeks was that Alibaba faces a lot more stiff competition at the moment than Tencent does. And so Tencent's earnings had a beat, and we can talk about that too. But Alibaba, a couple of things. Doug mentioned one, that basically there was some unexplained losses in its holdings of public companies. And that's one thing. But it also had to spend more to fight off the competition, and it was costly.
Absolutely, Brian. And I think you got it exactly right. Alibaba's competitive landscape is so different from Tencent. In years past, it used to be that Alibaba was the big dog in e-commerce, and in the same way that Tencent is with games publishing. And Tencent's situation is still the case. It's still the world's biggest games publisher. It's the biggest by far in China. It only has NetEase to compete with. Whereas Alibaba, on the other hand, you have ByteDance coming in, you have PDD. Everyone is getting into its turf. So one of the things that stood out from Alibaba's announcement was they mentioned, with respect to Tmall and Taobao, price competitive. They mentioned it a couple of times in their announcement. So really what they're saying is it costs us money to compete. These guys are undercutting us, so we need to undercut them back.
You know, sometimes the candy, I mean, at least these days for the market, has been any mention of artificial intelligence. Where do Baba and Tencent come down vis-a-vis, you know, this move into AI?
Right, that's another commonality for both of them. They consider AI a central pillar. Now, the detail is where it becomes interesting, and we don't have enough detail from either company. I mean, one of the things that Alibaba has mentioned for a couple of quarters now is that they will deploy generative AI to help make its e-commerce more appealing. I don't see how that's happening. I mean, these are two very different things. Generative AI is something that's still very nascent, very early, and nobody's really figured out exactly how to deploy it, whereas e-commerce, there are proven ways to entice people to buy stuff. And actually, at the moment, the thing that's really doing it is short video. It's stuff like TikTok and Douyin. Yeah. And that's the thing that Tencent is leaning into with WeChat, and it's WeChat video. So one of the big figures that Tencent reported is 80% growth in user time spent in WeChat video accounts. And what really that says, WeChat video accounts, you can equate that to Tencent's TikTok. The more people using that service, the more that Tencent can monetize, the more it can introduce e-commerce opportunities.
So in other words, we should not read that 26% rise in ad sales by Tencent. We probably shouldn't take that as a good barometer on the Chinese economy. It's more like the algorithm. It's more like what they're doing to attract and keep WeChat users with those short-form videos.
That's right, Brian. If you want to flatter Tencent for their execution, you're free to do that. But I think you're right. I think you're correct.
Well, I was going to flatter you by saying you're the big dog on looking at these big tech companies.
Well, here's the thing. Alibaba's chairman, Zhou Tsai, he said that the company is seeing positive signs of the Chinese consumer being willing to spend again. That was not the same sentiment coming out of Tencent. Martin Lau, the president of Tencent, he said that the Chinese economy is mixed and therefore the advertising landscape necessarily is also mixed. So Tencent itself is taking the credit for this as well. They're saying that they're doing better, and they do give some credit to AI helping them optimize ads on WeChat and other platforms.
So when you're a company like Alibaba, Vlad, and you're struggling, is the remedy, at least in the short term, stock buyback? Is that enough to kind of get the market a little enthused?
Well, Brian said it. I mean, you said it yourself. The stock market is not reacting positively. They did announce a $4 billion buyback, so everyone is quite serious. One of the really interesting things across the tech ecosystem, no matter the geography, is that everyone's doing a buyback right now. We're talking Sony in Japan, Alibaba, Tencent has one in ongoing. Apple announced the world's biggest buyback ever. Google, Meta, everyone is doing it right now because they have been sitting on these big cash piles. And at the same time as they're investing heavily in AI, and this is true both for Tencent and Alibaba, one of the ways that they can, like you say, sustain the share price and give some satisfaction to investors is to give some money back.
We saw a little bit of caution in games for Tencent. Walk us through some of the details there.
Well, I mean, this is the other really interesting thing. To hear Tencent talk about his business, it keeps talking about high-quality growth and how it's kind of shifting away from games. But then to hear the analysts on the analyst call and their priorities and questions, they keep focusing on games. And here's the thing. Tencent is now talking more about gross receipts as well as revenue, which kind of muddies the picture. So if you look at domestic games, they were up 3% in gross receipts, but down 2% in revenue. So those are the growth figures, much like e-commerce for Alibaba, that everyone is really paying attention to. Gaming is still the biggest thing. And that growth rate is never rising above 3, 4% each quarter. And it's tricky for it's tricky for Tencent to do anything about this because they are relying on a lot of evergreen games and they don't really have that games pipeline that's necessary to fire up new growth.
You know, when I think about Alibaba and the fact that we had put so much stock in the possibility of some spin-offs here, IPOs of different divisions, I mean, that seems to be really off the table right now. I mean, is that going to eventually occur, do you think? Is it in Baba's best interest to spin off some of these divisions?
Well, never say never on that happening again, but let's bear in mind that that was under the leadership of Daniel Zhang, who was the previous CEO, and the new CEO, Eddie Wu, and even the earnings announcement last night, very much stressed the synergy. I mean, this is the funny thing. We talked about IPOs and spinning stuff off. Now Alibaba is all about synergy. One of the ways that they highlighted this was Kai Niao, the logistics unit. They said several times it's doing a lot to help both e-commerce domestically, but also the international arms for things like AliExpress. A lot of the growth for the logistics unit is coming out of helping the international e-commerce, which is actually the one with the healthiest growth. That grew by 45%.
I'll give you some numbers here, which I know you know, but the audience may not. That's quite astounding. Tencent's revenue was roughly $22 billion. Alibaba's $31 billion. Mm. Yet, Tencent's market cap is double that of Alibaba. That tells you a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, as a gamer, I can just say that it tells you a lot about the value of games. But really, the way that you should think about this is games, software, these are things with a low cost base. Like the marginal cost of selling another game is nothing, basically, versus Alibaba having to do all this logistics, having to do all this investment in data centers and so on in order to provide its AI services to people. And the really interesting thing with Tencent, and it's something that they kind of picked up on in the call, was the fact that they can entice people via WeChat, via all these consumer services into its broader ecosystem of services that includes AI, generative AI, and such other subscriptions that they might be able to provide.
So, Vlad, when you consider guidance, I mean, is this something that was played up a lot? I mean, and what do we know about the trajectory of growth that these companies see right now in the current environment?
Well, I don't know that we got great visibility from either company. I mean, Alibaba said that they will keep investing in Taobao and Tmall. They will keep competing with the likes of PDD that I mentioned. As for Tencent, they do anticipate things improving in the second half, they said. And one of the interesting things, I mean, they mentioned a number of games that they consider kind of flagship games that are going to fire up growth in their estimation. I'm not really sure about this because the blockbuster games that we see on the global stage, half the time they're kind of unpredictable. I mean, we had a game like Powerworld that came out of nowhere. So the thing, again, with the gaming ecosystem is you're not really sure what is going to be an absolute runaway hit. So we kind of have to play that as it goes.
And just briefly, I know you're peripherally familiar with Ant Group as well. Quarterly earnings down 19%. Struggling to find new drivers of growth.
And honestly, I can't explain that one because being based here in Hong Kong, anytime I get to a checkout, I see Alipay as an option. Not so much WeChat Pay. So as far as Alibaba and Ant getting the distribution, getting the reach, and getting all the retailers to embrace their payment system, even here in Hong Kong, it's kind of ubiquitous. And probably that is the strongest indicator to the earlier point, Brian, about the Chinese consumer. So maybe Alibaba tells us it's seeing signs of it recovering, but the facts are telling us otherwise.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, Vlad. Vlad Savov with us, Bloomberg Tech editor, talking Alibaba and Tencent, and even a little there on Ant.
This has been the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast, bringing you the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. Visit the Bloomberg podcast channel on YouTube to get more episodes of this and other shows from Bloomberg. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.